If you are the sort of person who likes guessing games, you may wish to spend the next few moments pondering which of these explanations seem to have merit and which don't. Hint: of the 7 major explanations on the list, only 3 can be shown to have contributed to the drop in crime. The others are, for the most part, figments of someone's imagination, self-interest, or wishful thinking. Further hint: one of the greatest measurable causes of the crime drop does not appear on the list at all, for it didn't receive a single newspaper mention. Let's begin with a fairly uncontroversial one: the strong economy. The decline in crime that began in the early 1990s was accompanied by a blistering national economy and a significant drop in unemployment. It might seem to follow that the economy was a hammer that helped beat down crime. But a closer look at the data destroys this theory. It is true that a stronger job market may make certain crimes relatively less attractive, but that is only the case for crimes with a direct financial motivation, burglary, robbery, and auto theft, as opposed to violent crimes like homicide, assault, and rape. Moreover, studies have shown that an unemployment decline of 1 percentage point accounts for a 1% drop in nonviolent crime. During the 1990s, the unemployment rate fell by 2 percentage points. Nonviolent crime, meanwhile, fell by 40%. But an even bigger flaw in the strong economy theory concerns violent crime. Homicide fell at a greater rate during the 1990s than any other sort of crime, and a number of reliable studies have shown virtually no link between the economy and violent crime. This weak link is made even weaker by glancing back to a recent decade, the 1960s, when the economy went on a wild growth spurt, and so did violent crime. So, while a strong 1990s economy might have seemed, on the surface, a likely explanation for the drop in crime, it almost certainly didn't affect criminal behavior in any significant way. Unless, that is, the economy is construed in a broader sense, as a means to build and maintain hundreds of prisons. Let's now consider another crime drop explanation: increased reliance on prisons. It might help to start by flipping this crime question around. Instead of wondering what made crime fall, think about this: why had it risen so dramatically in the first place? During the first half of the 20th century, the incidence of violent crime in the United States was, for the most part, fairly steady. But in the early 1960s, it began to climb. In retrospect, it's clear that one of the major factors pushing this trend was a more lenient justice system. Conviction rates declined during the 1960s, and criminals who were convicted served shorter sentences. This trend was driven in part by an expansion in the rights of people accused of crimes, a long overdue expansion, some would argue. Others would argue that the expansion went too far. At the same time, politicians were growing increasingly softer on crime, quote, for fear of sounding racist, as the economist Gary Becker has written, quote, since African Americans and Hispanics commit a disproportionate share of felonies. So, if you were the kind of person who might want to commit a crime, the incentives were lining up in your favor: a slimmer likelihood of being convicted, and, if convicted, a shorter prison term. Because criminals respond to incentives as readily as anyone, the result was a surge in crime. It took some time and a great deal of political turmoil, but these incentives were eventually curtailed. Criminals who would have previously been set free, for drug-related offenses and parole revocation in particular, were instead locked up. Between 1980 and 2000, there was a 15-fold increase in the number of people sent to prison on drug charges. Many other sentences, especially for violent crime, were lengthened. The total effect was dramatic. By 2000, more than 2 million people were in prison, roughly 4 times the number as of 1972. Fully half of that increase took place during the 1990s. The evidence linking increased punishment with lower crime rates is very strong. Harsh prison terms have been shown to act as both a deterrent for the would-be criminal on the street and a prophylactic for the would-be criminal who's already locked up. Logical as this may sound, some criminologists have fought the logic. A 1977 academic study called On Behalf of a Moratorium on Prison Construction noted that crime rates tend to be high when imprisonment rates are high, and concluded that crime would fall if imprisonment rates could only be lowered. Fortunately, jailers did not suddenly turn loose their wards and sit back waiting for crime to fall. As the political scientist John J. DiIulio Jr. later commented, apparently, it takes a PhD in criminology to doubt that keeping dangerous criminals incarcerated cuts crime. The moratorium argument rests on a fundamental confusion of correlation and causality. Consider a parallel argument. The mayor of a city sees that his citizens celebrate wildly when their team wins the World Series. He is intrigued by this correlation, but, like the moratorium author, fails to see the direction in which the correlation runs. So, the following year, the mayor decrees that his citizens start celebrating the World Series before the first pitch is thrown, an act that, in his confused mind, will ensure a victory. There are plenty of reasons to dislike the huge surge in the prison population. Not everyone is pleased that such a significant fraction of Americans, especially Black Americans, live behind bars. Nor does prison even begin to address the root causes of crime, which are diverse and complex. Lastly, prison is hardly a cheap solution. It costs about $25,000 a year to keep someone incarcerated. But if the goal here is to explain the drop in crime in the 1990s, imprisonment is certainly one of the key answers. It accounts for roughly one-third of the drop in crime. Another crime drop explanation is often cited in tandem with imprisonment, the increased use of capital punishment. The number of executions in the United States quadrupled between the 1980s and the 1990s, leading many people to conclude, in the context of a debate that has been going on for decades, that capital punishment helped drive down crime. Lost in this debate, however, are two important facts. First, given the rarity with which executions are carried out in this country and the long delays in doing so, no reasonable criminal should be deterred by the threat of execution. Even though capital punishment quadrupled within a decade, there were still only 478 executions in the entire United States during the 1990s. Any parent who has ever said to a recalcitrant child, "Okay, I'm going to count to 10, and this time I'm really going to punish you," knows the difference between deterrent and empty threat. New York State, for instance, has not, as of this recording, executed a single criminal since reinstituting its death penalty in 1995. Even among prisoners on death row, the annual execution rate is only 2%, compared with the 7% annual chance of dying faced by a member of the Black Gangster Disciple Nation crack gang. If life on death row is safer than life on the streets, it's hard to believe that the fear of execution is a driving force in a criminal's calculus. Like the $3 fine for late arriving parents at the Israeli daycare centers, the negative incentive of capital punishment simply isn't serious enough for a criminal to change his behavior. The second flaw in the capital punishment argument is even more obvious. Assume for a moment that the death penalty is a deterrent. How much crime does it actually deter? The economist Isaac Ehrlich, in an oft-cited 1975 paper, put forth an estimate that is generally considered optimistic. He said that executing one criminal translates into 7 fewer homicides that the criminal might have committed. Now do the math. In 1991, there were 14 executions in the United States. In 2001, there were 66. According to Ehrlich's calculation, those 52 additional executions would have accounted for 364 fewer homicides in 2001. Not a small drop, to be sure, but less than 4% of the actual decrease in homicides that year. So, even in a death penalty advocate's best-case scenario, capital punishment could explain only 1/25 of the drop in homicides in the 1990s. And, because the death penalty is rarely given for crimes other than homicide, its deterrent effect cannot account for a speck of decline in other violent crimes. It is extremely unlikely, therefore, that the death penalty, as currently practiced in the United States, exerts any real influence on crime rates. Even many of its one-time supporters have come to this conclusion. I feel morally and intellectually obligated simply to concede that the death penalty experiment has failed, said U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry A. Blackmun in 1994, nearly 20 years after he had voted for its reinstatement. I no longer shall tinker with the machinery of death.